You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. Join me as we uncover the rich histories of North America's Great Plains, exploring the latest archaeological discoveries and past cultures that shaped this storied region. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Carlton Shield, Chief Gover. And for tonight's episode, we are joined by Dr. Spencer Pelton, the Wyoming State Archaeologist, who's going to lead us into the rich and fascinating histories of the Northwest Great Plains, specifically, you know, Wyoming and its adjacent region. Spencer, thank you so much for being on. How are you doing tonight?
Thanks for having me back, Carlton. Hopefully I'm a much-loved guest on the Archaeology Podcast Network. I seem to do this every other week or so. But yeah, I'm doing very well tonight. Thanks
Absolutely.
For asking.
Of course, man. Super happy to have you on. For those that have been following for a while, you do know that Spencer's made a couple appearances on the old podcast, Life and Ruins, as well as a guest on Ethnosinology. So we're always happy to have Dr. Pelton join us to talk to us about his work. And so we kind of want to dive in. So for those that are listening, all the previous episodes that Spencer has been in, we'll put links to them in the show notes below. So if you want to learn about his career and some of the previous things we've talked about with him, go to those episodes. But tonight, I really just kind of want to start us off with a site that has implications like beyond, you know, just the state of Wyoming, but it is the Powers II Ochre Mine, which is like, what is it, 48PL330 is its trinomial out there in Sunrise, Wyoming?
That's correct.
Excellent. So what is going on with Powers, Spencer? What's the significance of the Powers II Ochre Mine, and how are you involved in that research?
Powers has been known about for a really long time, actually close to a century, but it really didn't come to the attention of archaeologists till the 1980s when George Frison did a little bit of work there. That work didn't last long, and so it really wasn't within about the past decade when archaeologists really dove in to try to start understanding the site. I worked there between 2017 and 2020. And when I started, George Frison and George Siemens had been working there for a few years, just pulling these amazing artifacts out of the talus slope below the site. So all these artifacts are basically in a redeposited context on the valley floor. They thought the first thing to do going back into the site was recover as many of those as possible to get an idea of what these artifacts look like. And so my first several years at Wyoming, they were bringing in these amazing artifacts in the department constantly, these Riker mounts full of Paleo-Indian points of basically every variety. And so towards the end of my PhD, I volunteered to step up and help with the site. They really twisted my arm to help out with the Powers II site, one of the craziest sites in North America. So our goal going into excavating the site was basically just to provide some context for all these redeposited artifacts from the intact portion of the site, or what we thought was the intact portion of the site. So we spent four seasons there, about 40 days of field work, excavating a trench through the intact portion of the site, and ended up documenting an intact hematite quarry, or red ochre quarry. It was full of just thousands and thousands of pretty amazing artifacts that spanned about 12,800 to probably about 11,800 years ago or so. Really some of the earliest years of occupation in Wyoming where people were mining hematite out of this quarry.
Excellent. So hematite, you know, ochre is a red mineral. You get like a dust, a powder out of it, and you mix it with like bison tallow or bison fat and some other things, and you can make paint out of it. So with these early occupations at Powers II and people mining ochre, like we know ye old world, looking at Europe, the Middle East, where we do see evidence of ochre, people are using it to paint cave walls. So are we able to make that like reasonable assumption using that middle range theory that people coming into the first peoples of coming into Wyoming are bringing in that knowledge of hematite and gravitating towards this site as one of the, you know, earliest known areas where they can collect it maybe before they have located other sources?
Yeah, I think that's completely fair assumption to make. I mean, hematite, the use of hematite as red ochre is really one of the oldest forms of symbolic expression in the hominid lineage. You can track it from Africa all the way up through Eurasia to Northeast Eurasia into the New World, and seemingly an unbroken line of behavior. People are always using this stuff basically from the very origins of modern humanity in Africa. And so I do think that the first people in the New World, this would have been a high priority for them, was finding a really high quality source of hematite that they could rely upon and use. And it does seem to be the case. That's true. This is one of the oldest archaeological sites in Wyoming, one of the oldest ones in the New World within a couple hundred years. It seems to be a very important thing. And I should note that this particular source of hematite's everywhere, like paint rock and creeks, the little cobbles that you can kind of paint your skin with, that's hematite too. The difference with this hematite is that it's coming out of a really high quality iron ore source. So it's called specular hematite. So when it comes out of the ground, it's actually silver. It's a silver mineral that kind of comes out in these odd crystals out of this formation that kind of looks like cauliflower at times. So it's silver, but when you paint your body with it, it's red. It's silver in appearance, but it streaks red. So it's literally what magic is, right? It's a magic trick using this hematite because it looks a different color than it actually paints on your body. I think that had to have been a huge draw for the first peoples in the New World.
So how are they mining this stuff, right? Because the people are not coming in from East Asia and Northwest Alaska, like the Bering Strait, with iron pickaxes and shovels. Like, they're using old school technology. So how are they doing this?
Yeah, it's a good question, because when you talk about minerals and rocks, people assume that it's hard rock. Like, it's something that you'd need industrial scale machinery to deal with. But this type of hematite, specular hematite, is actually pretty soft. You can actually break it apart with your hands really easily. You can crush it with your hands against other rocks. And so what we found in the intact portions of the Powers II site were digging implements, primarily made out of antlers and the long bones and ribs of bison, almost solely bison. And the antlers, we have really solid evidence that there's deer. And also, it seems to be that there's at least one caribou antler in the site as well, attesting to the notion that caribou were much further south in North America, down into Wyoming at the end of the Pleistocene. So I think what people were doing was they found this nice high-quality source of hematite is probably cropping out at the surface. And so they just started using these long pieces of antler and ribs and split up long bones and just started prying up rock and chipping into this soft stone with these really robust bison and Tikwas long bones that had been kind of fractured into these picks, and just slowly removing the overburden off of this seam of the mineral to get at the really good stuff that was slightly buried. And over several hundred years, worked that seam deeper and deeper until it really wasn't a viable source anymore because there were so many tailings kind of piling up around it.
Excellent. And so this Powers II ochre mine is in the Hartville Uplift, which is really well known for its dendritic chert. It's that beautiful, like, red, yellow, orange stuff that you find, you know, especially in the central Great Plains, where you have folks coming out from Nebraska and northern Kansas hunting bison in the summertime out in eastern Wyoming, but also collecting raw material sources because there's no real good lithic material in central Nebraska. Are you seeing a presence of any other sort of non-local stone materials present at Powers II, or is it predominantly Hartville Uplift chert, or are you finding obsidian out there either?
I will say that it's predominantly Hartville Uplift chert, but the non-local sources of chert we did get out of the site are really telling of how this hematite might be spreading across the plains. So I think significantly, no, we don't have any obsidian, and really we don't have any rock from anywhere in the interior of the Rocky Mountains. You know, the Hartville Uplift basically sits right at the margin of the Rocky Mountains and the High Plains. It's really the kind of the last stop as you come out of the Rocky Mountains and going out on the High Plains that you can have some shelter and, like you say, some good sources of raw material like hematite and stone. So it was right at the margin of the Rocky Mountains, yet there's no Rocky Mountains raw materials in it. The ones that we're familiar with, like Tiger Chert in southwest Wyoming, which shows up in the Clovis record, or obsidian from Obsidian Cliff, which also shows up at that time. What we do have instead is we have Knife River Flint from western North Dakota, which is coming from a pretty good ways away. We have porcellanite from the Powder River Basin, which is a couple hundred kilometers north of the site. And I think most impressively, we have what you'd call, at least in the Texas Panhandle, Alabates chert, and also Edwards Plateau chert as well, from all the way south in Texas. Not much of it, a couple tools for both of those raw materials. But it looks like people are coming to this site from very long distances, or at least trading raw materials into the site from very long distances, and more or less a north to south pattern, going all the way from pretty close to the Canadian border all the way to central Texas. And I wouldn't be surprised if we found evidence for Powers II hematite in sites at that far of a distance as well, that people were really locked into this source and exchanging it to basically every corner of the Great Plains.
That's just absolutely fascinating. And are you able to, with ochre, are you able to identify, do geochemical analysis to identify its source?
Yeah, you are. We've messed around with a couple of different techniques. The first technique, Sandra Zarzycka, a former master's student at the University of Wyoming, she uses a technique called ICP-MS, whose acronym I can't remember. Inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry, that's it. And that seemed to discriminate the powers to hematite source pretty well from another source north of Rawlins, Wyoming, and then some local sources of hematite out of the creeks at the Laprelle site. So that provided a nice link between the Laprelle site, Laprelle, Clovis, and Folsom site near Douglas, about 80 kilometers away from Powers 2. It's also been sourced from the Hell Gap site as well, which is kind of just over the hill. Since then, we've been experimenting with other techniques. Denise Hoth, another University of Wyoming master's student, messed around with doing some portable X-ray for fluorescence on hematite, and that seemed to also discriminate it pretty well. And I should just reiterate, this is a really distinct source of hematite. It's really unlike other sources in the state because it's derived from this iron ore body and it's specular hematite. So it underwent a very different formation process than a lot of other hematite. So it has really interesting trace and minor elements in it, like arsenic, for instance, things that you don't necessarily get in like your typical paint rock that you get out of a sedimentary formation out of a creek.
Excellent. So there is that connection between, so the Laprelle Mammoth Kill site, right? That's where a juvenile Colombian mammoth was butchered by a group of hunter-gatherers. It's like Clovis age. Also, there's a Folsom Point there too.
There's a Clovis and a Folsom Point, and it's about, 12,900 years old or so.
Got you. And one of the most significant things about that site is that it seems like after they butchered that mammoth or killed that mammoth, they had a party because there is a, like, how large is that ochre splatter across the site?
It's 3 or 4 meters across. And, the interesting thing about that is, I've dug a lot of sites in Wyoming at this point. I've been on, several dozen digs, I guess, not including just minor testing. The only sites I've been on in Wyoming that have stains like that are early Paleo-Indian sites. There's a stain like that at Hell Gap. There's a stain like that at the Sheeman site up in the Southern Black Hills. There's that stain at Laprelle. It seems to be very much a Clovis Folsom kind of phenomenon. I don't know what it means. I don't know if they were having an ochre party, like you said, which is quite possible. I do think that ochre in some way was a hell of a lot more important among these earliest people in Wyoming than it was for later peoples for whatever reason.
Fair enough, man. Well, all right. So do we see continued, when it comes to indigenous populations in North America, do we see use of that site beyond the Paleo-Indian period? Because we know later, the site is within the town of Sunrise, which was an iron mine, right? Now it's a ghost town, but that settlement grew up around mining iron.
Right. So at the Powers 2 site itself, no, we didn't find any evidence that people used it after about 11,500 years ago or so. I did talk to one of the people that's investigating it more recently that said they found some other stuff like this summer. I haven't seen it yet. But as far as I'm concerned, the work that I did and everything I looked at, it was really old. It got stopped being used 11,500 years ago. But that being said, there's a really interesting newspaper article from 1890 something from the Guernsey Gazette that was reporting on this mining district up around Sunrise. There's a couple other ghost towns up there too. And they described this crevice that some of the miners found that they went inside that was full of pottery and arrowheads and all these ancient tools. And they just started describing this ancient red paint mine that these miners found. They didn't really describe exactly where it was. We don't really know where it was. Presumably, it's been destroyed since in the process of mining iron out of these huge iron deposits. But it is suggestive that there were other quarries like this in this iron mining district that were just destroyed by the iron mining operations throughout the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
Dang, that's impressive. As we just talked about in an episode from 2 weeks ago with Mike Page, right, looking at the breadth of pottery in Wyoming, and there's pottery traditions in Wyoming go pretty deep. So, that's a 2,000-year span in which those miners could be describing some sort of occupation. But still, that's absolutely incredible. And with that, we're going to go ahead and take our first break. We'll be right back with Dr. Spencer Pelton right after these messages. And welcome back to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. We are here with, still here with Dr. Spencer Pelton. And so just kind of like going, like literally going across the ridge from Powers 2 and into Hell Gap, 48GO335 sounds?
305.
305, yeah. Spencer has done a number of things over at the Hell Gap site. We've talked, I think I've talked about the site on this podcast before myself. I've been doing some recent excavations there, but a huge contribution to understanding the site itself was Spencer did a Bayesian age depth model on the site chronology. And so Spencer, can you talk to us about what got you interested in doing such a project and, you know, just the significance of Hell Gap in general?
Yeah, I'll be frank. So I got into Hell Gap because I was Marcel Kornfeld's graduate assistant when I was in my PhD program. And when you're Marcel's graduate assistant, you don't grade papers. You just like write reports for him and stuff like that. So that's how I got into Hell Gap. And so in the process of doing that, at the time I was taking like a biogeography class and we were learning some of these skills that like paleoecologists use, like age depth modeling for pollen cores and that kind of thing. And so I got the notion that for my project for that class, I'd try to do an age depth model for an archaeological site, for like an open site. And the difficult thing about doing age depth models for open sites is that the dates aren't just stacked neatly on top of each other like they are in a pollen core. And in open sites, the dates are kind of all over the place and they're from strata, they're dipping in different directions and they're undulating in thickness. And you have all these problems with like rodents burrowing into the sediments and displacing carbon up and down. There's just a bunch of complicated things to deal with. And so I tackled that problem to build a age depth model for Hell Gap. I think in general, you haven't talked about it much on this podcast. I'll give you the cliff notes on it. It was, you know, one of the first archaeological sites on the Great Plains where you had all the earliest cultures in the New World stacked on top of each other in one place. And specifically at locality one of Hell Gap, because look, Hell Gap is an entire valley filled with archaeology. And there's all these different localities that have been identified over about half a mile to a mile stretch of this creek. Locality one is really the richest of those localities in terms of how much early archaeology is stacked on top of each other in that one place. So for this age depth model, I use locality one specifically because Marcel Kornfeld and Mary Lou Larson have been doing work there for years, trying to reevaluate the integrity of the sediments there. How exactly stratified is it? Are things actually neatly separated into these nice fine layers where you have Clovis and then Folsom and then Midland and then Agate Basin and Hell Gap and all these cultures on up? Or is it kind of muddled? Is it a little more complicated than that? So their work was really focused on sorting that out. And I used some of their research to build this age depth model. Long story short, Hell Gap is one of the most well-dated Paleo-Indian sites in the country, but that also makes it kind of difficult to tell exactly how old these different cultural units are. You know, which of 15 dates on the Folsom level is actually the age of the Folsom level, right? And so these Bayesian techniques kind of help you clear that up. And specifically, I used this age depth model, which really allows you to identify outlying dates in the stratigraphic column and say like, okay, we're not going to use these that are a little unreliable and focus in on the most solid radiocarbon dates and estimate ages accordingly.
Excellent. And so what did you end up finding out? Were they pretty sequential or was there some overlap going on?
There's a lot of overlap, but you can identify really specific occupation events. So when you look at what we call a vertical density plot of artifact distributions, which is basically just a bar graph turned on its side, you can see all these little spikes in the distribution of artifacts up to these, you know, 2 to 3 meters of sediments they have there. And each of those spikes really represents a cultural occupation. It's where an influx of flakes and bones and artifacts occurs. And then you get a little sediment built on top of that and you get another influx of it and it goes on up. But then over the ensuing 12,000 years, right, you get rodents and roots and stuff moving through it and artifacts move up and down. So it kind of muddles those peaks a little bit. But despite that, we could identify really defined peaks. I think off the top of my head, we got about 13 individual occupations identified, including Goshen occupation that dated to about 12,800 years ago. That seems to be the earliest occupation at the site. No less than 3 Folsom occupations stacked on top of each other that you could identify. And then on up through Agate Basin, Hell Gap, Alberta, Cody Complex, and Frederick at the very top. So it's not as clear as you'd like it to be. It's not these Pompeii situations that archaeologists always dream about, where you get a nice layer of artifacts with then a layer of sand just gently washes over it the next year and completely seals it. And then that repeats the next year, and the next year it stacks up nicely like that. But it's not that bad. I think compared to some of the sites down in the southern plains, like Galt, it's a lot better preserved than a site like that, which seems to be extremely mixed up and has been for a really long time, because the sediments there just, they shrink and they swell, and artifacts just get displaced like crazy in sediments like that. And it's really hard to discern cultural levels when you have a site that's that disturbed. Hellgap is not like that. It seems to have a pretty good amount of integrity.
Yeah, I mean, looking at Galt, I didn't realize that it was just like clay, that there was really no stratigraphy, that it was just a wall of clay. But that makes sense. Hellgap was part of a recent analysis that Dr. Todd Serville has done, looking at like site integrity. He came up with that model to identify like how much movement has occurred from a site.
Yeah, and yeah, that was my contribution to that paper, was the Hellgap data. I worked on that data and contributed to that study. But yeah, that's an interesting study. And that study basically formalizes kind of the process I was just referring to, where you can actually look at the distribution of artifacts stratigraphically in just a vertical density plot and get some idea of how disturbed it is or not based on how peaked those influxes of artifacts are. Because if you have a really disturbed site, you just don't see any peaks in artifact distribution at all. It's just this kind of continuous mat of stuff from surface all the way to bedrock. And so what Todd did was develop this quantitative index for using those vertical density plots to actually tell people or tell an investigator how intact their site is or how disturbed it is.
Absolutely. And so bringing a couple things together here, like looking at powers, looking at the Paleo-Indian and like transitional Paleo-Indian archaic components at Hellgap, and also bringing into conversations of Prell that we talked about with Maddie Mackey, and then a little bit further away, like you can get to, I said Alm, I meant Laprelle. Laprelle is like, what, a 45-minute drive from Hellgap?
Yeah.
You know, back then people didn't have cars, but still like it's within a day or two walk. And even kind of looking at what Bob and Crabo were doing up at Alm, what do these types of sites, like rock shelter, bison kill and processing site, a mammoth kill and processing site, and then an ochre mine, tell us about human behavior at the end of the last ice age?
Oh man, it's a big question. They could tell us a lot of stuff though. I mean, you know, rock shelters and in general stratified sites tell us fundamentally different things than say a kill site. Because stratified sites, you get at the diachronic problems, right? You get it changed through time because all these other factors are held constant, place and resource abundance and all this stuff. And so they're really great for that. What they're not great at, I would say, is informing things like lithic technology, because almost everything in campsites is busted up and fragmented. They also don't tend to have a lot of fidelity to them in terms of just spatial integrity, because people reuse these places. They kick around stuff. They displace artifacts. They live on top of other people's stuff. They dig down into other people's stuff. This is a classic example at Alm, for instance. Alm is just this kind of mess of features that are just features excavated into sediments that are, you know, 2,000 years older than the surface that they're on. And those 2,000-year artifacts get churned up and get placed in sediments that are 2,000 years younger. It just gets really messy like that. So that being said, those are the best places to study change through time. On the other hand, things like kill sites, mammoth sites, bison kill sites, these are much more of these classic, you know, snapshots in time sort of scenarios. Bison kill sites, they are reused, especially later in the record, but a lot of them in the Paleo-Indian record are one and done sorts of sites. And these are snapshots in time of the life of these people at the end of the Ice Age, over the course of, you know, several days or a week or something, as they killed bison and processed them and processed the meat from them, maybe processed some hides, camped around them for a bit and moved on. Those sites are really good for informing a day in the life sort of questions of Paleo-Indians, like how did they make projectile points? How did they butcher animals? Really detailed nuances of how you butcher animals. What season are they killing animals? So I would say that, you know, stratified sites and these other sorts of sites are really informed two very different things. In aggregate, you can start getting at the big picture questions, right? Like mobility, what directions are people moving? What seasons are people spending in what places? How big are the social groups based on campsite size? So yeah, if you want specifics about how people were living, I could hand wave some stuff, which is basically that in eastern Wyoming, people were quarrying a bunch of minerals and rocks in the Hartville Uplift in the winter and camping there. They're probably moving up the North Platte River into the Rocky Mountains during the summer months and killing bison and mammoths all on the way, and then probably returning to the Hartville Uplift on an annual basis to hunker down for the winter months. Guernsey is a hell of a lot better place to be in the winter than, say, you know, Rollins, just because of elevation, climate, snowpack, and that kind of thing.
Excellent, because like during this time, right, we still have like glaciers. We're on the precipice of the major aspects of the Rocky Mountains. Canada's is still kind of pretty well covered by a glacier itself. So these folks in eastern Wyoming and the Northwest Plains are really living on that northern fringe, the ability, you know, the furthest extents you could get to in North America, as you're talking about, something you mentioned, like later in the Paleo-Indian times, in Archaic, you see the habitual use of bison kills. And when we're talking about Paleo-Indian populations, these are the first peoples in these areas. They might not be totally attuned to the environment yet, or the seasonality of food, or they don't have that landscape knowledge quite yet that we see later in places where you have, especially on the Rocky Mountain Front Range, we have the bison jumps, habitual use of bison jumps, or as you get to the central and southern plains where you see people using arroyos as continual traps. And so to me, it all makes sense, right? During a Paleo-Indian period, you have people just figuring it out and taking advantage when they can.
I'll echo the thought that it was a pretty extreme environment. I do think we have direct archaeological evidence for that, and just the sheer quantity of bone needles we have in the record, which in my mind, and I've talked about this elsewhere and I wrote a dissertation about it, but they're pretty good evidence for people making cold weather garments, parkas, fitted clothing, things like that. Things that you would need to withstand life, not too damn far off the margin of a continental glacier, and certainly in the middle of the Rocky Mountains when it's really cold at the end of the ice age. And, you know, Hell Gap has bone needles. I think I'm breaking this here for the first time, but I'm pretty sure Powers 2 has bone needles, but I need to double check it under some microscopes. They're just extremely common in these really early sites in Wyoming, more common than really any other time period in Wyoming and in any other state in the Union. That I think that's not an accident. It's because it's a really harsh place to live at the end of the Ice Age, and people are sewing clothing to cope with those conditions.
Yeah, habitual. I mean, hell, we found bone needles up at Alm. Like, we were there when with Bob, and I think it was Kitchell who found the first one, and Bob Kelly's sitting there like, this is the first bone needle I've ever found in my career. And then like the next day we found a second one. He's like, keep digging, right? Like, and
I know one of the Chinese students found one too. We immediately opened up the block, and this Chinese student during this exchange program got in the block, and Bob was giving his talk about, you know, ideally we would excavate the site one grain of sand at a time, but we just can't do that. He's just talking all every time, which is a good talk. It's a good construct. I'm not dishing it. But this Chinese student's like watching this, and he stoops down and picks up this bone needle. He goes, what's this? And it was a complete bone needle. And it was incredible. Yeah.
That is intense. Yeah, I mean, like, I think that point, like, I just finished my first year as a master's student. I really didn't realize the significance of, at that time of my graduate career, like the work that you all were doing, your cohort and our professors, and identifying like these components, right? Because like Doc Frizen, rest in peace, like bison guy, the first Wyoming State archaeologist whose title you now have, very focused on bison, and the subsequent generations that came after refocusing on mammoths, HBE, and these ochre mines. And Doc was always, you know, he was present in the background being that guidance. But it's just incredible. And it's like, and I know I've said this before, it's awesome to see your progression in the career, from going from Tennessee to CSU and Wyoming, and then being able to become the Wyoming State Archaeologist. It's just like incredible. It's always fun to see what you're doing and what everyone else is doing up at the University of Wyoming. Go Pokes.
Go Pokes. It's great to catch up with you. And then I would say likewise, You hadn't done too shabby for yourself either, Carlton. I've been there for a while too. I don't remember when you were at Wyoming, but
I was there for a flash in the pan, just 2 years. I was one of those lowly master students in and out. But yeah, we have to go back to the archives for Jones Miller to tie something up before we can publish the models on that. And I still have, I know we had talked like years ago about looking at some of the, comparing the dates from some Agate Basin and Hellgap sites to actually build that chronology out across Rocky Mountain region. So we'll stay in tune. Be fantastic to publish with you. I was warned at Plains when I was talking to a bunch of colleagues about doing some co-authorships, and I was like, Matt Hill or Mary Adair, who's like, you know, you have to, you need to be careful how many people you publish with before tenure, because someone has to write your tenure packet and they can't do that if they've published with you. I was like,
yeah, you do make a good point though. Maybe this is a good place to wrap up, but as a result of all this work on these sites in Wyoming, we have this amazing collection of stuff, bison bones, flakes, just this amazing collection of artifacts from sites from the earliest people in the New World. And it's here to facilitate like research like you just talked about, where we could do these big comparative studies and dating bison all across the Great Plains. And it's a really valuable resource that we're lucky to have at the University of Wyoming and that our office is fortunate to manage.
Absolutely. Well, all right. That was it for this episode with Dr. Spencer Pelton. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. We're going to take a quick intermission from Wyoming archaeology. We're going to interview Dave Williams, who's the Nebraska State archaeologist. We're going to hop across the border real quick. Sail down the, I guess, canoe down, probably walk. The Republican River is sandy. You can't sail down there. I'm going to take a stroll down the Republican River back near Lincoln and talk to Dave about some of his work. And we'll be back with some more Wyoming archaeology. So stay tuned, everybody. Thank you for listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. You can follow me on Instagram at Pawnee_archaeologist. And you can also email me at greatplainsarcpodcast@gmail.com. And remember, anybody can love the mountains, but it takes a soul to love the prairie. American author Willa Cather.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.